Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to the A's Plus Podcast. I'm John Shea, national baseball writer of the San Francisco Chronicle, and our guest is Steve Vucinich, A's clubhouse manager and A's historian, really, who shares some wonderful stories and his thoughts on his 54 years on the job and his upcoming retirement.
What a pleasure to be hanging out with Steve Vucinich, the awesome longtime clubhouse manager of the A's, who has said this will be his final year, sadly for us, but wonderful for you, Steve. I mean, 1968, Charlie Finley, all new to the Bay Area, a 15-year-old kid, you know, running around in clubhouses as a bat boy and doing all the duties that you did, and to moving up the ladder and running the clubhouse the past several decades. Well, first of all, congratulations on the upcoming retirement, and thanks for hanging out.
John, it's always a pleasure to do these podcasts with you, Susan, or anybody. I enjoy reminiscing.
Well, much appreciated. Now, this is your 54th season, and when the team went back to Philadelphia, the Historical Society noted that you actually will be surpassing Connie Mack as maybe the longest tenured employee in A's history, which is pretty amazing. But you know, he played for 11 seasons, but never for the A's. He played in the 1800s, so it's kind of safe to say that it's an incredible feat on any front, but. Well, what was it like working the clubhouse with Connie Mack? No, I'm just kidding. That was before your time. But maybe you could tell me the secret to longevity, durability, because you have to be a people person, man. I mean, you have to get along with people. You make people comfortable. That's for starters, I imagine, right?
Absolutely. You have to be able to know when to be quiet, know when to speak. As a 15-year-old kid working in a clubhouse, you just kind of sat back and listened to people. You didn't talk to anybody unless they talked to you first. And like I said, adapt to the changes. I was growing up at the time, kind of starry-eyed with these professional athletes about how they went about their business, how they conducted themselves, either with the media or just their teammates or coaching staff. So. It was an eye-opening experience, a wonderful experience, and I wouldn't trade it for the world. I mean, now the position I've risen to, there's only 30 of those jobs in the U.S.,
yeah.
And I can say U.S. because Blue Jays don't look like they're going to Toronto.
No.
But it's been a fun time. I've cherished every moment of the friendships I've made across the U.S., seeing guys come out and call and talk to me while we're in Boston, ex-Red Sox guys that I'd heard about my upcoming retirement shows you the value of friendships. And, you know, I lasted because I cared and I obviously did the job right. It's, you know, I use the line that I know where the bodies are buried, but we know that's not true.
Well, when the book comes out, we'll know it's true. No, I imagine there's no book. Well, hey, Mike Murphy of the Giants wrote a book with Chris Haft, which I loved. Are we going to see some documentation of some great storytelling in book form, Steve?
I don't know about book form. I'm kind of remembering and speaking in a recorder about stories that shouldn't be forgotten and the different ways the ball club and baseball's evolved. And so, you know, I want those to be documented, some things that shouldn't be forgotten. I don't know about book form, but at least I'm in the recorder and eventually put it on paper.
In oral history, I'd love that. You really are NA's or the A's historian, because you know, nobody has been there front and center like you have. So it's not like you just read about it; you lived it. You were there, and you know, Steve, baseball is such an evolving game. It evolves year to year, changes. week to week, day to day, especially in recent time with all the changes across the board. And, you know, people either change or don't stay in it. How have you evolved as a person and in your role? Because equipment changes, but, you know, bats and gloves, of course, but also mindsets and strategies and philosophies and game plans.
And nowadays you have players that have done nothing but play baseball. They've come up through the travel squads, and so they're more fundamental about the game, and they understand it. And in a position like me, we have to be able to adapt to, hey, these guys maybe are once mindset as far as baseball. They're not open to other things. You have to read everybody different. There were guys like Milton Bradley, who was a wonderful individual, and I really liked the guy. But there were days you knew to stay away from him, and you didn't talk to him. And the same thing with Reggie Jackson. And that's not a knock on them. It's just moods, and not saying you're moody, but mood swings, and you have to adapt. You have to read into people like that. And I think that's in all walks of life. I've just been fortunate to be around headline-type guys and can read between the lines. So I'm fortunate that way. I was smart enough to realize that from the very beginning.
Yeah, you know, headline-type guys, oh my gosh. I mean, this A's run of yours, I kind of, you know, just off the top of my head, break it down into five eras. I mean, the 70s with the swinging A's and those three championships, and then Billy Ball with Ricky Henderson running all the time and Billy Martin making it happen and the sudden success after some down years. And then you evolved to La Russa and the Bash Brothers and those three World Series. And then, you know, years went by and then Giambi showed up and that fun, loose, wild clubhouse of the early 2000s and the success they had. And then now under Bob Melvin, which is another success story. I mean, is that fair to break them down? And how would you compare, you know, era to era? And did you have a favorite group among those?
Well, there's apples and oranges, yeah. Really. No disrespect to what you said. But there are different things that went into each situation. Tony La Russa came on just as the Steinbecks, Maguires, Canseco's were coming in their own, just as Dick Williams came in and really taught the guys how to play with fundamentals and things. And that was the Reggie Jackson and Sal Bando era. Their club had moved from Kansas City in 68. And in 1968, if they'd had the divisional format, we would have finished first. So we're expected to compete in 69-70. And finally won a division in 71 and won five straight divisions and three World Series. So you got that era, and then you've got some lean years in between, and we almost moved to Denver once, and New Orleans was rumored, and other places were rumored. So you're right, they're different eras. I used to just classify the early years, the competitive years, the championship years, the dead years. And then I stopped in 1981 with the Haas family, knowing the assurances of the club staying in Oakland and always being competitive. So the eras have been different. The personalities have been different. Baseball's still the game. We've added a designated hitter. Now with what's going on because of the COVID, the seven-inning doubleheaders and the run the extra inning rules. Things change. The NFL's changed more than anybody. The NBA's changed a lot. Baseball hadn't changed that much. So maybe it was time for all this to happen. And you look back at different eras, and nobody knew how to handle the DH. The DH is almost at the beginning. We're batting ninth because they didn't know where to put him. Our first DH, I think, was Billy North. And we thought of him as the second leadoff guy. Mm-hmm. So times have changed. Eras have changed. But it's still the same game on the field, really.
Yeah, nobody knew how to handle the DH. Just like when the NBA brought in the three-point line, nobody knew how, you know, should we shoot a lot? Should we shoot a little? When do you make that attempt? And now, you know, that's all they do.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so, you know, you've spoken about how Catfish Hunter is your all-time player, and correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, if so, why? You know, he was a true gentleman, right? He played for the A's, played for the Yankees, won World Series titles on both coasts, but Hall of Fame pitcher through, you know, just the first superstar pitcher really on the A's, on the Oakland A's. Maybe explain your fondness for Catfish.
Well, it was one of my first days on the job, and I'm a ball boy down the left field line, and Catfish pitches a perfect game. The only perfect game I'd ever heard about before was Jim Bunnings and Sandy Koufax, and that's from afar, just really reading in the paper. You didn't have baseball highlights daily. So Catfish pitches this game, and then after the game we find out it's the first one in 46 years. And you have to think about that, 46 years. It's almost 50 years. It's almost five decades or into the fifth decade. So the enormity of that game just stuck in my head. And then watch him handle himself. We didn't have throws of media. You didn't have electronic media around. How he handled himself, talked to everybody. And it's right then that I could see that he was kind of leader of the pitching staff. Sal was emerging as a team leader, but Catfish was kind of leader of the pitching staff. And then when it was all said and done, most people are gone, he just sat there and talked to us bat boys for 10, 15 minutes. And it was just such an impression. And then following his career the rest of the way, and knowing him personally, and I've been to his farm a couple times, he's just a down-home country boy. They don't call him Catfish back in Hartford. They just called him Jimmy. And Catfish was a Charlie Finley baseball name. So he just such an impression. And a hard worker. Hardworking then didn't include the weight room, didn't include running that much. But he went about his business. He didn't have to study film and stuff back then because it wasn't available. But he knew how to pitch.
We will be back with more of Steve Vucinich right after this quick break.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
You know, when the team was in Boston recently, there were two amazing stories in the first two games. Chris Bassett, who's been around quite a while, but surprisingly had never pitched at Fenway, and now he's making his first start. And he won the game in dominating fashion, and he talked about Fenway nerves in that first inning and overcoming them. And then the next day, James Kaprielian making his first big league start ever anywhere, and it just so happened to be at Fenway with his animated father in the crowd and the memory of his mother front and center, Barbara Kaprielian, who died in 2014, a year before the Yankees drafted the kid in the first round. But it's just so heartwarming, some of these stories that play out in front of us every day. How close do you monitor these stories? These are your guys. I mean, they're putting it all on the field and walking away with wonderful memories and stories to share, and you're witnessing this stuff.
You know, it's an honor to do that, and those stories play out every day in the big leagues, and not just the first 2 days in Fenway. But, you know, you are aware of it. I've been a big Bassett fan since we acquired him from the White Sox, and then he went down with the injury, and I saw how hard he worked to come back. And I thought he'd have some success. It's funny, one of the nicknames that people had for him over the years is Marmaduke, because his body just flails all over like a cartoon character. So to see him achieve that success, you know, and kind of surprised you that was his first game at Fenway. Well, we didn't come here last year. The year before, he might not have been in a rotation when we came here, or we just missed him on those starting dates.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a freak thing that he didn't pitch here. But, you know, then again, we only make one trip to the East Coast anymore, to each city, with the unbalanced schedule. So, and then Kaprielian, I mean, I knew about him. I was told when we made the trade by the Yankee personnel that he was going to be in the starting rotation that year until he blew out the last week of spring training. So, you know, we had to grin and bear it, go through his rehab and surgery, and watch him come back. And I always thought he had a big league head. He understood pitching. came from a good program at UCLA. You know, I rooted for both those guys so much, along with Frankie Montez and some of the setbacks he's had. So, you know, you like to, I won't say pick on somebody, but kind of follow their career, pay a little bit more attention to them than you would some of the other guys for no reason other than you rooted for a guy like that.
Yeah.
I almost had tears in my eyes on Caprillion when I gave him, I got a dozen authenticated baseballs for him to give away to maybe family members, former coaches, things like that from his first big league win.
Wow.
And I almost came to tears giving him to him because I was so happy for him. I really was.
That is awesome. That's a behind-the-scenes story that we don't always hear about. But what was his reaction when you gave it to him, the box?
He just had no idea. He knew he'd probably get the lineup card, which we will. We'll frame that along with the game ball. But he had no idea that we could do something like that. So that made it really special.
That's really cool. Well, Steve, it's out there, the news that Major League Baseball has given the A's okay to explore other markets, and you know you've seen this, you've lived it. I mean, Oakland is all you've known, the Coliseum is all you've known. Just curious on your take and you know the hope that the A's stay in Oakland, and whether it's at the site they're looking at, whether it's somewhere else, but. You know, we've gone down this road before because Charlie Finley, was about to sell the team to some Denver interests, and the Haas family moved in. But anyway, what's your take on the stadium issue?
Well, I'm hoping they can get it done. I mean, it looks like a beautiful venue and a great spot location. I've seen other cities build ballparks downtown, like the Giants have. Pittsburgh has, you know, a bunch of them have, and revitalizes downtown, but it does complement it and help the revitalization, and that would happen at the waterfront ballpark. And if that can't fly, they've got to find another way to keep it in Oakland where it's there, maybe at the Coliseum site, although I'm hearing that's not a possibility. But if you like it to stay in Oakland, we came so close to moving to Denver twice in the late 70s. In fact, in 1978, we took our equipment truck and it went from Mesa, and we told them to drive to Las Vegas. And then I'd tell them, then they would call us, and I had to make sure that I was around to answer the call. It's not like cell phones, and you didn't have switchboards at the minor, at the ballparks at the time in spring training. So I had to make sure I had the right time to call and give him directions whether he goes northeast or northwest with a truck to Denver or to Oakland. And then that year, Charlie Finley was so sure that he sold the club to Marvin Davis, the billionaire oil man from Denver, that we opened the season in Anaheim. And Charlie was there and told everybody, don't rent a place in Oakland because the second homestand will probably be playing in Denver. That would have been an unprecedented move in the middle of the season. But we've come that close before to losing the club for various reasons. They stayed in Oakland, and actually the Raiders situation in the early 80s helped us stay in Oakland because we had an ironclad lease that couldn't be broken at the time, and the Raiders' lease was expiring. So we've come close before, really hoping. I mean, I tell people I believe green like Tommy sort of bleeds blue. I hate to see this club go anywhere but open. So I'm rooting for them to do it any way they can.
Well, speaking of bleeding green, you've always had the most unique color combinations in baseball, green and gold with the white spikes. And what are your thoughts on that combination? And has there ever been a movement to change those colors?
We've tweaked it. You know, we went dark green in the 80s, and now we're coming back with some more Kelly green combinations.
And
getting away from the green and gold, no. The white shoes, look how many guys in baseball are wearing white shoes now. A few years ago when they loosened the restrictions on colors of shoes, I saw Gio Gonzalez wearing white shoes who was pitching for Washington. I said, Gio, you want to wear white? Come back to Oakland. But the different color combinations for shoes, we're not the only ones wearing whites now. All kinds of clubs are, but not as a mandate. And, you know, people don't realize we weren't the only club to wear whites way back in the 60s and 70s. The Senators did in D.C. The Angels did for a few years, but then they got back to the traditional colors. And now you can pretty much wear any color. But the green and gold, only other clubs have experimented with some green. Milwaukee did one year. So did Tampa. But not full-fledged color combination of green and gold that we have today or in the past. And we can thank Charlie Finley for that. He wanted to bring some color into the game, and kudos to him for that.
A man before his time on many fronts. You were speaking about the DH earlier, and that was his introduction and his idea in a lot of ways. Hey, what's the clubhouse like with no beat writers? I mean, not since the end of 19 were the media allowed in the room. What's the vibe? Pre-game, post-game, when oftentimes the scribes are interviewing guys or waiting to do so, but for now, none of that.
Well, it's less crowded, and in that respect, I go back to the old clubhouse in Oakland, which is now our new weight room. We took the lockers out, and we're up in a Raider locker room. So with the small locker room that we had before, and the riders were kind of congregated, there's no place to really sit on the side, so they'd congregate in the corner by the door that goes down to the field, and it kind of made it kind of crowded, and some of the players kind of felt like, hey, where are you going to turn your heads? You're just staring at us. If you were in the clubhouse now in Oakland, we wouldn't even feel that. We've gone from the smallest home clubhouse in baseball to probably the largest, taking over the Raider facility upstairs. So it is kind of weird because I miss seeing you guys on a daily basis. I'd always have some banter for Susan if she wrote something wrong or covered something wrong or somebody else did, just to tweak her a little bit. But I love seeing Vernon Glenn come in with his little stool so he can stand as tall as everybody else. So it is different. We don't see the coverage that we got before, but hopefully that will return someday.
Yeah, that's what we on our front are sort of missing, the intimacy and the ability to speak with folks and, you know, collect the scene and describe the scene. And that's kind of what baseball, it's set apart from other sports. It was always the access and the intimacy and the ability to storytell that readers and fans would always, you know, appreciate, and, you know, trying to do our best over Zoom and, you know, phone calls or whatever, but including this one. But winding down here, I'm just curious if there's has there been one, like, the most usual request from a player, I mean, G-rated here, that you could recall, because they ask a lot of things of you, and you always come through, and some of them might not be so standard.
Over the years in visiting clubhouse, I had Roger Clemens ask me about 6 o'clock at night if I could get a birthday cake for his wife, and he could bring it back to the hotel. I had one that I turned down. We were leaving Anaheim a few years ago, and one player came to me and says, hey, can you send one of your guys over to San Francisco to this real special restaurant and pick up my meal and have it delivered to me when I get off the plane in Oakland? And to that, I said no.
The only time you said no ever.
there are probably a few more, but I was adamant about that because I said, we're not just going to be food runners. I mean, when a player comes in and needs a prescription filled and or he needs an errand run, it's no problem. We can send somebody out, but that was way over and board.
That's funny. Well, this is it's pretty cool, Steve. I mean, it's one market, and you and Mike Murphy, who's still with the Giants, and you know, he started in '58, 10 years before the A's came along, at Seal Stadium as a bat boy, then worked himself up into the different clubhouse roles. And have you ever shared trade secrets over the years with Murph?
With Murph and other people, because that just kind of keeps you on top. You find some club is doing certain things a different way, and you want to learn from that experience and keep up with them. And I've had guys come to me and ask me questions. So Murph and I told Murph 5 years ago, I said, Murph, you can retire tomorrow, and I'm not catching you. he's got 10 years on me, so what's that, 118 right there? I don't know if you saw it. I tweeted out a picture from Baltimore on the last road trip with the two clubhouse guys in Baltimore, Jimmy and Freddie, Tyler and Mickey, and the four of us, we had 213 years between us.
That was awesome.
So these are jobs that you keep because you love them, you have fun, you love the game, and you do a good job if you're staying that long. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So maybe the last thing, what do you think you'll miss, and what are your plans for 2022 in retirement? If I'm not mistaken, you're actually going to work through spring training, right, next year?
I am. It makes sense. I love the winter stuff. I love spring training, and I live down there. It makes it easy. What I'm going to do is I've already got a cruise to Alaska with a train trip up to Denali planned for July of 2022. Jeez. But what I'm going to miss the most are the relationships I have with players, former players, coaches, other front office executives throughout baseball that I've seen come through there. That's what you miss the most. I mean, we have fun on the job. I tell my guys, I said, if you're not having fun on this job, then you shouldn't be here, because we can tease each other within the proper guidelines nowadays. But the relationships is what I'm going to miss the most. I mean, even with the media, I mean, I was good friends with, I still am, with Tracy Ringlesby and Peter Gammons, who I didn't, for the first time ever, didn't get to see him this trip into Boston. Guys, national guys like Nick Cafardo and Bill Madden, and then TV people like Matty Beskurgeon, who grew up in Orinda and a big A's fan, and we banter back and forth all the time. And that's what I'm going to miss the most, there's no doubt.
And it all started back in the day with Ron Bergman.
You're right, and Bergie and I were great friends. We'd go to the Cal football games together.
You know, I lied. There is one more question. Everyone has a great Charlie O story, everyone at least who's been associated with the team going back to those years. What is yours?
Well, I think it's more of a how was Charlie, how did he handle things. He would... You know, I wasn't at the top of the lines at the time Charlie owned the team too much, but he would still call me from time to time. And back in the day, before long-distance calls were so cheap as they are now, he would spend maybe $7 on a phone call to you to bitch about a $5 laundry bill. But Charlie always treated me fine. I have no qualms. I'm still friends with Paul Finley. His son is about my age. But some of the stories about Charlie... wanting to make out the lineup, I don't think that's as true as they were made out to be. The hiring of different managers, we went 1-1-1. I mean, from Jack McKeon to Bobby Winkles to Jim Marshall to Billy Martin. Nobody thought the Charlie Finley and Billy Martin relationship would last. Well, Charlie was smart enough to hire Billy because that created interest, and that's where the Haas family stepped in. Mm-hmm. So as far as Charlie had a big ego. He wanted to be front and center. He would only come into town in the heydays maybe 5-6 times a year because he'd see the teams on the East Coast and when it came to the Chicago and the Midwest. But everybody knew when Charlie was coming. They tried to keep it a secret in the office, but we all knew because all of a sudden the few people we did have in the front office would all of a sudden be wearing ties. Charlie was a baseball man at heart, and he loved the game too.
Well, this is fabulous. Thank you so much, Steve, and congrats again, and good luck moving forward.
All right, John. Thanks for the call, and miss not seeing you around.
Thanks for joining us on the A's Plus podcast, and stay tuned for more podcasts through the summer and beyond.